Moving on now, it's well known that Boston was a center of the abolitionist movement and that the Northeast provided a lot of help to runaway slaves along the so-called Underground Railroad, which was a loose network of people and safe houses. Now a new book from Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Eric Foner sheds new light on how the Underground Railroad was organized and how it operated.
Foner's book includes a dramatic tale of Henry Box Brown, a slave in Richmond, Virginia. After his wife and son were sold, a white Massachusetts shoemaker packed Brown into a 3-foot-long crate and shipped him to Philadelphia by rail and boat. Brown survived the difficult journey, and with help from others, he made it to New York, Boston, and to New Bedford, where he joined his sister.
His story is one of the many that Eric Foner tells in Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad. When Eric Foner joined us recently, he told us that his book was based largely on the discovery of a series of records that belonged to Sidney Howard Gay, a journalist from Hingham, Massachusetts. He became editor of the National Anti-Slavery Standard in New York and interviewed some 200 runaway slaves and left behind detailed notes.
Gay recorded who these slaves were, who owned them, how they escaped, who helped them on their way, what he did, in other words, sending them to Boston or to Albany, Syracuse, Canada, even how much money he spent for train tickets. So this document, which covers 2 years in the mid-1850s, is a remarkable contemporary account of how the Underground Railroad operated, how and why slaves escaped. And as I say, it's pretty remarkable. It had almost never been used before. I stumbled upon it, I have to say, with the assistance of an undergraduate student who was writing something else.
This is amazing. I love this part of the story. I mean, you found out about these documents almost by accident, and yet they're so hugely significant.
Totally by accident. As I say, a very kind undergraduate history major who was working on Gay's journalistic career said, you know, Professor, in Box 72, there's this thing about fugitives. You might find it interesting. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Sure. I want to ask you a little bit more about that story I opened with that you write about Henry Box Brown, who had himself shipped to freedom in a box, an amazing story. And you write in the book that Brown's story inspired other slaves to try to replicate his mode of escape. Were they successful?
Some of them were and some of them weren't. I mean, it was a pretty dangerous thing, obviously. There was a danger of suffocation. You know, you're in a box being shipped on a train or a boat, and other boxes can be piled on top of you. There may be no air. It may be impossible. At one point, his box was, he was upside down for several hours, which is dangerous. So, yeah, the story became very widely known, and other slaves got the idea. And I give an example. You know, one or two did escape, and then there was one who died along the way. And when the box was opened, their corpse was found. One box broke open during the trip, and so the fugitive slave was apprehended. But it's an example of the ingenuity. One of the things in this document of Gay's is the amazing creativity of fugitives in figuring out ways to escape. You know, we have an image, which is not untrue, of slaves running away on foot, going through the woods at night. But they used all sorts of other methods. They stole horse-drawn carriages and rode off in them. They got onto boats, often with the assistance of black sailors or crew members. Many of them escaped by train. By the 1850s, the Underground Railroad was sort of literal in the sense that the train network in the East was pretty much completed. There were many, many ways that slaves chose to try to escape.
Fascinating. Now, Sidney Howard Gay also interviewed these slaves about their experiences as slaves and what really compelled them to flee. What did they tell him specifically about what was going on, about why they wanted to flee?
Usually it was some specific incident. And the most common I found reading through this was just physical abuse, you know, whippings, beatings, just general bad treatment. And the way these slaves described their owners as brutal, as violent, as, you know, a mean person, or one called his owner the worst owner in Virginia, you know, it gives you a sense of a visceral sense of the violence which was really at the core of slavery. So second only to that was fear of being sold. Many, like Brown, ran away when loved ones were sold. Usually we're talking about people in the Upper South, Virginia, Maryland, and their wife, child, or something would be sold to the Deep South. And once that happened, a lot of people said, "Well, what the hell? I'm not staying here anymore, and I'm getting out." Or they heard rumors they were going to be sold. You know, slaves, I think it's fair to say, generally were not very contented. But to run away was a very radical step. It was very dangerous. It was not easy at all. We don't know how many tried to escape and failed, but probably more were captured on the way than actually got to the North.
Let me come back to the Henry Box Brown story, only because I want to ask you a little bit about sort of New England's role and Boston's role. Mm-hmm. And in his case, New Bedford. He ends up in New Bedford where his sister was. And then, if I'm recalling correctly, he sails off to England. But why New Bedford? What role did New Bedford play in the Underground
Railway? Yeah, there's a very fine book about New Bedford. Working on ships was one of the major occupations available to free black people in the North. They were barred from most occupations. So New Bedford had a very strong free black community of maritime people, and it became a center where fugitive slaves could basically find safety. Many fugitive slaves end up in New Bedford. But after 1850, after the passage of the new federal fugitive slave law of 1850, it became much more dangerous. The federal government took on the responsibility of capturing and returning fugitive slaves, and people who had lived in Boston, other parts of Massachusetts, quite peacefully as fugitives, suddenly had to flee. Many thousands of blacks fled the country for Canada who had been living in the North for many years after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, because that really made the recapture of fugitives much more effective.
Tell us more about that Fugitive Slave Act, because one of the things you write about that this had a huge impact and really became one of the causes of the Civil War.
Well, absolutely. First of all, it had a dreadful impact on free black communities. There weren't that many free blacks in the North. I think in 1860, there were only 220,000 in the whole North. So that's not out of 23 million people. But there were these little communities in cities mostly, Cincinnati, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. And once the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, many of them decided they were no longer safe, because the Fugitive Slave Law was retroactive. You could have escaped 20 years before and been living peacefully and have a wife and child and everything, and suddenly the police or the federal marshals really could come and arrest you. And so it really disrupted these free black communities. Now, you know, we tend to think very often of the Old South as believing in states' rights. You know, in fact, there are people who believe wrongly, I think, that slavery was not really the main cause of the Civil War. It was states' rights. But here's a case where the South is demanding vigorous federal action, overriding local judicial proceedings, local laws that try to protect people from being grabbed and sent back to slavery. The South wanted all those states' rights abrogated, and the federal – this was the strongest federal intervention in local affairs on any issue before the Civil War, and this was demanded by the South as part of the defense of slavery. So many Northerners became more and more resentful about the Fugitive Slave Law, about federal marshals just coming in and grabbing people, federal troops. You know, in Boston in 1854, the slave Anthony Burns was apprehended, taken before a federal commissioner, and ordered to be sent back to the South. And it took U.S. troops to come into Boston and march Anthony Burns down the street to the harbor where federal marshals put him on a ship to send him back to the South. So this was a pretty shocking thing for many Bostonians, even those who were not really abolitionists in any way, but to see the federal government kind of just come in and military force to take one sole person back to slavery certainly alarmed many people.
Interesting. Now, you write a lot about how New York City played a central role in the Underground Railway, but it was also a center of kidnapping of freed black people. And we one prominent story about this was the subject of 12 Years a Slave about Solomon Northup. Tell us about how common this was and how it would happen.
It was quite common in the 1820s and 30s. It tended to fade out after that as the anti-slavery movement grew. But both in New York and Philadelphia, it was not uncommon for usually a child. Northrop was an adult, but usually it was children just grabbed off the street and rushed to a ship and sent down to the South. You know, after the end of the importation of slaves from Africa in 1808, the price of slaves rose dramatically because, you know, supply and demand, you might say. The supply from overseas was no longer there. slaves were very valuable. If you could grab a kid and kidnap him and sell him in the South, you would make a lot of money. And there were gangs of kidnappers who operated on the streets of New York, the streets of Philadelphia. Now, obviously, this is illegal to kidnap somebody, but local officials in New York, some of them were quite willing to go along with this. New York was very closely tied to the slave South. New York merchants basically controlled the cotton trade in that period. New York bankers helped to finance the expansion of slavery. New York insurance companies sold insurance policies on slaves to their owners. New York's economy was very tied into the South, and there were a lot of public officials who were perfectly happy to, you know, stand up for slavery and work in common with slave owners.
Mm. I want to ask you a little more about what you learned from Sidney Howard Gay's documents about the Underground Railroad. You write about a new understanding about how the Underground Railroad was organized.
Yeah, you know, Gay's document is also very revealing about the Underground Railroad itself. And I think what it shows is, which is pretty remarkable, that a very small number of people could do a lot to help fugitive slaves. We should not think of the Underground Railroad as a giant, highly organized system with regular routes like a real railroad,
sure,
you know, or stations along the way, secret passwords. You know, there's a kind of mythology of the Underground Railroad which greatly exaggerates how systematic it was. But here you did have a station or an office in New York City where a handful of people, Sidney Howard Gay, a couple of black men who worked in his office, and a few others in the neighborhood who he worked along with. There were not more than a dozen people at any one time actively working to help fugitive slaves in New York City. And yet, my estimate is, over the period from about 1830 to 1860, they helped about 100 a year, let's say 3,000 slaves, pass through New York City on their way to freedom. Now, you know, there were 4 million slaves in the South in 1860, so the escape of 1,000 a year, or whatever it is in the whole South, is not going to undermine slavery. But nonetheless, this was a small, it was an interracial group. One of the things that's very striking, this was a case of black and white people working together for a common cause. Gay is white. He's got two black men working with him in his office. And they were able to achieve a remarkable amount, but it was always on the edge. They never had enough money. They had to go begging around for money to help these slaves.
Given 4 million people enslaved, it didn't deliver lots of people to freedom, but you make the point that it had a huge political impact that really helped ignite the Civil War.
Well, yes, this became and there it's the actions of fugitives who run away, number one, and then the people who help them, number two, that put this issue on the national political agenda. And, you know, it became more and more of a point of dispute or annoyance in the South that there were these operations helping fugitive slaves because of the way it was violating one of their constitutional protections.
Well, it's an amazing and troubling story. You tell it incredibly well. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about
this.
Well,
I appreciate that very much, and great to talk to you.
That's Eric Foner. He's a professor of history at Columbia University. His latest book is Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad. He'll be giving a three-part lecture, by the way, about the book at Harvard University early next month. There's more information at radioboston.org.
And before we go, let's get an update on the blizzard. That's expected to be record-breaking with heavy snow and strong winds over the next couple of days. Joining us is WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Hello, David.
Hello, Deborah. How are you?
Okay, well, tell us about the path of this storm right now. Where is it and what is it doing where it is?
Right. So, you know, in New York City right now, they have heavy snow, so visibility is down to a quarter mile. And the storm is developing off the New Jersey coastline at the present time. There's a pretty good area of snow, some of it moderate, around New York City. Then there's a little bit of a break. And then we're also beginning to see some precipitation start to develop over the south shore of Massachusetts. And that, over the next few hours, will start to move inland. And, of course, as it moves into the cold air, even if it is rain over, say, Nantucket or over the ocean, it's going to fall as snow once it gets here.
Uh-huh. And give us a quick reminder of the totals that we're talking about in the locations.
Yeah, so generally we're talking 20 to 30 inches. It's amazing that I'm actually saying those numbers and saying them as a general accumulation, not just sort of, you know, here or there. So that is basically eastern Massachusetts. The exceptions are going to be Cape Cod and the islands, where there will be less. As you head towards the canal, you figure 14 to as much as 22 inches, and then you'll go into that 20 to 30 inches north of there. The outer part of the Cape, generally 6 to 12 inches, because it will be a little bit warmer. The snow is heavier and wetter, so it will mix with some rain.
All right. WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, thank you.
You're welcome.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Bundle up, stay warm, stay off the roads. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.